Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the New Yorker Hour. Today, I'm going to start off reading from a posting on the New Yorker's webpage. It is What Dayton's Mayor Wants America to Learn from Her City. It's by Paige Williams. After a local resident killed 9 people, Nan Whaley navigates the politics of gun control and a visit by President Trump. On Saturday, August 3rd, Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, Ohio, had a day off and a full schedule. She attended a Baptist minister's hooding ceremony, a public event for a Japanese sister city, and a luau held by a local nonprofit CEO. That night, she and her husband, Sam Braun, joined friends at a cookout. By 11:30, she was home, knowing that she would spend Sunday in Cincinnati celebrating her mother's birthday. A few hours later, Whaley was sleeping deeply when her doorbell rang. Whaley lives in Five Oaks, one of the most diverse neighborhoods in Dayton, a metropolitan area of about 800,000 people. She and Braun bought their historic 4-bedroom house in 2008 for less than $70,000. Braun, who Whaley told me is obsessed with the yard, often chats with the children who walk or ride their bikes down the street. When a young boy once asked if it was true that the mayor lived there, and Braun confirmed the rumor, the boy didn't believe it. He told Braun that he thought mayors lived in bigger houses. Until last week, Whaley had no security detail. Neighbors and strangers often walked right up to her door, mostly to borrow something, like the lawnmower, or sell something, like religion. But no one ever rang the bell at 4:30 in the morning. Whaley nudged Braun and asked him to come downstairs with her. She grabbed her phone in case of emergency. When she discovered a member of the city's legal staff on her porch, she knew the news was bad. Dayton has experienced one troubling event after another since the spring. In late May, 9 members of an Indiana group affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan held a rally at Courthouse Square. Whaley still isn't sure why they chose Dayton. At least 500 counter-protesters, some of them heavily armed with assault-style rifles, chains, bats, poles, and sticks, arrived to oppose them. Complicating the standoff were memories of the deadly white supremacist demonstrations in Charlottesville and Ohio's longtime open carry laws, which allow gun owners to display their loaded guns in public. The event proved nonviolent, but it unnerved everyone and re-exposed racial divisions in a city that Whaley declared still too segregated and still too unequal. 2 days after the Klan rally on Memorial Day, 15 tornadoes struck the area, one narrowly missing Dayton Children's Hospital. No one in the area died as a direct result of the storms, but again, the community was left shaken. Now, on her porch in the early hours of a Sunday morning, Whaley heard her colleague utter a phrase that she had long feared and which was already familiar to hundreds of other American mayors: mass shooting. Whaley hurried upstairs, intending to throw on yoga pants. Braun, who also works for the city in the auditor's office, suggested that she go ahead and dress in work clothes. Whaley pulled on salmon-colored slacks, a dark jacket, and flats. She and Braun drove across the Miami River to the convention center being used as emergency command, and then walked to the Oregon District, the historic core of downtown. The neighborhood is filled with Victorian homes and apartments above storefronts. The main commercial corridor is Fifth Street, paved in red brick and lined for several blocks with locally owned boutiques, bars, and restaurants. Lucky's, Tumbleweed Connection, Gem City Tattoo Club, the Drunken Waffle. Locals know that at the Dublin Pub you should get the beef stew, that Lily's serves the best fried chicken, and that the Annex, a sex shop, is the quickest place to find a Dr. Pepper. They know that Ned Pepper's, a bar, is named not for a real person, but for an outlaw character in True Grit. They remember the bar next door hole in the wall from when it was exactly that, an actual hole in the wall and so devoid of signage that it might as well have been a speakeasy. They don't think of employees as the bartender or the bouncer, but rather as Lindsay or Taylor, although conversely, they've also known people for years without having ever learned their names. They know that when you want to dance or see DJs, you go to Ned's or Newcomb's, and that Hart Mercantile sells fun gifts such as socks printed with an image of a stressed-out Jesus saying, "I can't even." After the tornadoes, Hart made a batch of Dayton Strong T-shirts in response to the Klan rally. It ordered some that read, "Fuck racism." The Oregon district functions less like a city sector than a tight, weird, defiantly original little town, which was what made it so unreal to learn that one of its own had perpetrated such abject madness. Whaley was led past the whirring lights of the police who had swarmed the neighborhood and past dozens of yellow evidence markers. The bodies of the dead had been taken away. There were 10, including the gunman and his younger sister. Blood darkened the sidewalks and the street in enormous splotches and trail drops, stains that may always be visible. Traumatic experiences imprint surreal images on the human brain, and after surveying the devastation several times, Whaley registered various impressions. The sight of firefighters in hazmat suits washing down surfaces with bleach. A deserted taco truck, its food waiting to be served. The killer, Connor Betts, was a 24-year-old community college student who had worked at Chipotle. He fit the usual profile of a mass shooter in that he was young, white, and male, but otherwise there were contradictions. He had protested the Klan rally, and yet while in high school, he had been suspended twice for assembling a kill list and a rape list of people he wanted to hurt. He purportedly held progressive views and yet performed in a porno grind band, Menstrual Munchies, part of a music scene that had a regional following in the Midwest and is known for sexually violent, death-obsessed lyrics and dehumanizing imagery depicting women. That according to Vice. Song titles included Preteen Daughter Pussy Slaughter and Six Ways of Female Butchery. One band member, Jesse Creekbaum, told Vice that he's removing the band's albums from the internet to avoid making Betts a cult hero, saying, "I don't want any of this romanticized. I want people to erase him from history." Betts lived with his parents, Stephen and Moira, in the affluent suburb of Bellbrook, a hilly town of about 7,000, just southeast of Dayton. His parents had worked in software. Their business, Mindthern Technology, listed the family's home address as company headquarters, and according to archive pages of Mindthern's website, its clients have included the Army Reserve and the Air Force Institute of Technology. Mindthern advertised itself as a small, woman-owned business. Betts had a younger sister, Megan, who was 22. She attended Wright State University in Dayton, where she studied earth sciences and was expected to graduate next year. He liked his sister. Why would he kill his sister? An ex-girlfriend, Adelia Johnson, wrote in a statement that she provided to the Dayton Daily News. She added, "He didn't like his parents, but that couldn't have been the cause." Johnson wrote that she had met Betts in a college psychology class. Her recollections of his behavior filled out an unnerving portrait of a long-troubled young man. Former classmates described him as an oddball who gave off dark energy and made some people feel threatened or uncomfortable. Others remembered specific incidents that alarmed them enough to alert parents, school officials, and the police. In one, a former middle school classmate said that Betts admitted to having fantasized about, quote, "tying her up and slitting her throat," close quote. The former classmate, who spoke to the Dayton Daily News on the condition of anonymity, said that when she and her parents reported Betts' bizarre admission to the Bellbrook police, they felt they weren't being taken seriously. Another female classmate, who was reportedly among the 10 or so girls on Betts' high school hit list, told reporters that Betts would walk up to her and pretend to cut her throat or stab her stomach. Someone else said that Betts had talked recently about shooting up Timothy's, a bar near the University of Dayton. Even the shooter admitted he was scared of his thoughts, the Daily News reported. In college, Betts bonded with Johnson, the ex-girlfriend, over what she called depression humor. This past January, when he started joking about his dark thoughts, "I understood," Johnson wrote. Dark thoughts for someone with a mental illness are just a symptom that we have learned how to manage. On their first date, Betts had seemed charming to her with his big smile, baby blues, and intellect. That night in the bar, she found him outgoing and electric as they engaged in a political debate with a Republican. Betts then pulled out his phone and delivered a play-by-play of footage involving the deadly Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. "Even then, I did realize that that was a weird thing for a first date," Johnson wrote. But psychology students are often interested in what she calls the horrors of humans. Later in the relationship, when Betts confessed to having uncontrollable urges, Johnson dismissed it as the talk of a sad, drunk man who was afflicted by unchecked symptoms of mental illness. One passage in Johnson's missive stands out. "I have no idea what his motivation was," she wrote. "This wasn't a hate crime. He fought for equality. This wasn't a crime of passion. He didn't get passionate enough. This wasn't very premeditated. He wasn't a thorough planner." Betts supposedly had considered suicide. Johnson wrote that him getting shot is exactly what he wanted. Why, then, did he wear body armor? Why did he wear headphones as protection against the deafening gunfire? These were the questions now being asked of Whaley and Dayton's police chief, Richard Beale, a former Cincinnati cop who was regarded locally as a thoughtful, compassionate police chief. Beale cautioned that investigators, who now include the FBI because the shooter had articulated violent ideologies, will release details only after establishing a factual timeline. Betts apparently arrived in the Oregon District by car wearing khaki shorts, black sneakers, and a dark T-shirt. His sister and their friend, Chase Beard, were with him. Betts at some point separated from the other two. His car was later found near Blind Bob's across the street from Ned's. Somewhere, he had put on the tactical vest, the headphones, and a black mask, and picked up what people later described as a pistol that had been augmented with a brace. The weapon held two drums of .223 caliber bullets, a particularly destructive type of ammunition, containing up to 100 rounds. Betts walked up the alley beside Blind Bob's, ignoring an easily accessible crowd on the patio, before crossing Fifth. Dozens of people were outside, smoking and drinking. One couple was hugging as the shooting started. As it became clear what was happening, people fled down the tree-lined boulevard and into doorways and alleys. One man ran so hard that when he face-planted on the sidewalk, he skidded like a baseball player sliding into second. At Ned Pepper's, a long, cavernous bar with a tiki patio out back, a stout bouncer, Jeremy Ganger, ran out and herded people inside. Around 200 people were in there screaming and cowering. Cornelius Froelich, who covers City Hall for the Dayton Daily News and who had just gone home when the mayhem began, later told me that if Betts had made it into Ned Pepper's, there would have been a shooting gallery. There's nowhere to hide. The gunman was moving toward Ned's when police officers, who maintain a strong presence in the Oregon District, sprinted from an adjacent alley where they often congregate, their service weapons drawn. In 30 seconds, the shooter had fired an estimated 41 bullets. The police, advancing toward him, fired on him just as he turned and tried to run into Ned's. The killer fell to the ground, stopped moving, as they had been trained to do. They reportedly fired 65 shots in all. Ganger, the bouncer, bounded out of Ned's to where the shooter lay face down in the doorway and yanked the gun out of his hands. The responding police, Sergeant William Knight and the officers Jeremy Campbell, Vincent Carter, David Denlinger, Ryan Nabel, and Brian Rolfs, had neutralized the killer and saved scores of lives. 9 bystanders were dead. Megan Betts, Monica Burkhouse, Nicholas Kumer, Derek Fudge, Thomas McNichols, Lois Oglesby, Saeed Saleh, Logan Turner, and Beatrice Warren Curtis. The shooter was dead too, but the officers cuffed him anyway behind his back, as they were also trained to do. He lay with one leg askew. His belt appeared busted. A gash of red marked the flesh above his waistline. His T-shirt read, "No heart to feel, no soul to steal." Immediately, Dayton crawled with media. Whaley, as mayor, stood at the center of it. She's 43, with thick blonde hair, dimples, and an unpretentious manner. Before the shooting, she had experienced little demand to appear on national television, but now she was all over cable news, which she does not watch. The nation learned that she grew up in Indiana and graduated from the University of Dayton. A Democrat in a state governed by Republicans, she's been mayor for the past 6 years. She told me last week in Ohio, "Dayton's personality is one that's very inclusive and open, which is strange for a city our size. I always say that I'm a good example of this." She was talking about having become, at age 29, the youngest woman ever elected to the city commission. She said, "I was unmarried and I rented a house, but everyone's like, I'm going to take a chance on this girl. That wouldn't have happened in another community our size." She said, "I think of Dayton as a gritty sissy. I fell in love with it because it's very blue-collar. It's the quintessential, if you work hard and play by the rules, you should get ahead. What's heartbreaking to me is that that's not enough anymore." Traditionally, Dayton's city manager has overseen daily operations while the manager functioned more as a figurehead. The current city manager, Shelley Dickstein, was paid $207,464 last year, while Whaley was paid $55,189. But Whaley was first elected in 2013, has never been a figurehead. She said, "When I got in, I'd go to the meetings and they'd say, 'You're good, you're smart.' And I'd say, 'I know, I show up on time and speak in complete sentences. What a miracle.'" After 4 years, she was reelected, running unopposed in the first uncontested mayoral race in Dayton's history. She told me, "That surprised me. It's like not like everyone loves me." In 2017, Whaley briefly ran for governor. She'll probably run again. Sherrod Brown, Ohio's senior senator and a Democrat, told me that Whaley and he have been friends since around 2005. He said, "Nan came by her politics by sitting around the dinner table during the Reagan years, hearing her dad talk about how Reagan betrayed workers. She's always been a workers' right, civil rights, women's rights Democrat." In the wake of the shooting, Daytonians did seem to love her, with the visible exception of one garrulous older man who stood on Fifth Street with a homemade sign that read, "Fuck Nan Whaley." The night after the shooting, mourners cheered Whaley at a candlelight vigil and shouted at Governor Mike DeWine, chanting, "Do something, do something." 2 days after the shooting, DeWine unveiled a 16-point proposal, which Whaley endorsed, to reduce gun violence. Under the plan, relatives and others who are concerned could take out a safety protection order against anyone at risk of committing gun violence, and, after a court hearing, a judge could seize firearms from those deemed credible threats. The Republican governor and the Democratic mayor explained the details of this new initiative to me last week after they had lunch together at Lily's Bistro in the Oregon District. John Husted, the lieutenant governor, had joined them along with DeWine's wife, Fran, who had put on a Dayton Strong t-shirt over her blue dress and pearls. Whaley listened closely as DeWine explained. People said, do something. Now we're saying, you have the power to do something. She nodded when he added, every community has somebody who fits this category where everyone says, oh God, someday something's gonna happen. Whaley told me that she appreciated being included in these conversations. I always prefer folks that govern, not just advocates, she said. In governing, you've got to get it done. Makeshift memorials materialized at the scene of the shooting, as they always do. A recreational group plastered handwritten post-it notes to shop windows. You're braver than you think. Today is not the day to let fear win. Hart Mercantile ran out of Dayton Strong t-shirts and ordered more. The neighborhood regulars, vaping and drinking, both hugged everybody obsessively and hated on posers who never in a million years would have worn a Dayton Strong t-shirt, but now couldn't wait to get one. Whaley had always believed that Donald Trump's campaigning would never bring him to Dayton. She often told herself, I'll only have to deal with him if something bad happens. Then it became clear that Trump planned to visit both El Paso and Dayton, whose mass shootings had happened hours apart, leaving 32 dead and at least 52 injured altogether. Whaley and her staff had pretty healthy fights about whether to receive him, she told me. Whaley neither likes nor respects Trump. On TV, she had said that every politician has the power either to bring people together or to divide people. Trump, she told me, was doing the latter. She did respect the office of the president, though. She decided that she would meet with Trump when he visited Dayton and use the opportunity to urge him to revive the 1990s ban on assault-style weapons. She told me, every mayor wants something good to happen out of something bad. On Wednesday morning at around 11, Air Force One landed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Trump descended the plane's stairway in silence, with no audience of supporters to applaud him. A receiving line waited for him and his wife, Melania, following the hierarchy mandated by White House protocol. Governor, First Lady, Mayor, Senior Senator, Junior Senator, and so on. When Trump reached Whaley, he shook her hand, and she immediately brought up the reinstatement of the assault weapons ban. Trump moved on to Brown, who had not planned to meet with Trump until Whaley asked him to stand with her. It was a zillion Republican operatives and the White House staff and elected officials who didn't see the world the way Nan and I do, Brown told me. She and I were able to reinforce each other's arguments with the president. When the group prepared to leave for the Miami Valley Hospital to visit survivors and first responders, Whaley was relegated to traveling with the press pool. Notified of the snub, the two senior Ohio Republicans, DeWine and Senator Robert Portman, and Brown, sent a message. She's the mayor, and she's with us. At the hospital, Whaley and Brown found a second opportunity to press Trump on guns. Both told me that Brown advised Trump, you could pass an assault ban, you could bring it back. Whaley said that Trump asked, why did it lapse? Brown told him, Obama couldn't get the votes. Whaley told Trump, that's right, Mr. President, you could do something that Obama couldn't. After Trump met the six police officers who had stopped the shooter, Whaley heard him say, they're going to come to the White House, and I'm going to give them a big award. Brown told him, the best way to honor these officers and police everywhere is to get these guns off the street. Whaley told me, Trump kept saying he was going to do something, but I couldn't tell whether he was talking about legislation or very big awards. Trump left for El Paso. Whaley and Brown appeared in a press conference at City Hall. A couple of the cable networks carried it live. Trump apparently watched. At 3:48 p.m., he tweeted that Whaley and Brown had misrepresented his visit to Dayton. He called the news conference a fraud. A Cincinnati Inquirer reporter recorded a video of Whaley seeing the president's criticism and responding, "I'm really confused. We said he was treated like very well. Oh well, you know, he lives in his world of Twitter." Early the next morning, Whaley did a live interview with CNN in a back corner of the Legacy Pancake House, a Dayton icon. Afterward, she and I stayed at the Legacy for breakfast. The restaurant has been one of her favorites since college. You can get two eggs, toast, and jelly there for $2.75. The place draws truck drivers, light and power workers, and seniors who get a discount. That morning, a table full of FBI SWAT operators were sitting nearby dressed in fatigues, silently inhaling their food. The mayor, who tends to wear pants, flats, and structured tops, had on a bell-sleeved turquoise jacket over a white shirt. She ordered two poached eggs with hash browns, bacon, and cinnamon raisin toast. It was very dangerous to speculate about the mind of the president, but she said that maybe Trump had lashed out at her because he disliked her pushing him on guns. It shocked her that the culture of celebrity that usually surrounds a president seemed really heightened with this guy. At the hospital, survivors and their families were super excited to see him. That is absolutely true, but for her, the celebrity atmosphere was scary for democracy. A waitress brought our food and refilled our coffees. At one point, Whaley looked down at her white shirt, plucked a Tide stain remover pen from her bag, and erased a wayward speck of food. She was remembering other details about Trump's visit. It occurred to her, she told me, that the president seemingly had no compassion or emotion, no ability to read a room. He called Brown and her to the bedside of a patient and said, "These people used to be Democrats and now they're Republicans." Whaley told me this was a victim's room. Sherrod and I were like, "We hope you're okay." Trump didn't seem to understand that the people around him had been traumatized. Whaley said, "There's a guy in a Rutgers shirt," and the president's like, "Oh, did you go to Rutgers?" The guy's like, "No." Then the woman next to him says, "I got shot in the arm, but the worst part is the emotional trauma." I thought it was very brave to say that. The president went back to the guy in the Rutgers shirt and said, "You'll be okay. You're a very tough guy." Whaley, meanwhile, is so determined for Dayton to eradicate the stigma surrounding mental health issues that, after her own therapy appointment, she tweeted, "I have a counselor who I just went and talked to about how hard this week has been. If you need to talk to someone, do it." At the Pancake House, Whaley was drinking water from a tumbler branded with the logo of an iron workers union. Her father was an iron worker, as was her grandfather, whose nickname was Dynamite. Her mother was the elected clerk treasurer of Mooresville, Indiana. Whaley told me the town was like 5,000 people. Really conservative place. My parents went to college, but neither of them graduated. They were all about my brother and I going to college. Whaley studied chemistry. First-generation students have to do science or get a business degree so that you can get a job. And she ran her school's chapter of College Democrats. "When I came to Dayton, Bill Clinton was running for a re-election," she said. "My mother said, 'Ohio decides the presidency, so you better go help in the election.' I took a bus down to Democratic headquarters, and that's how I got involved." She worked on campaigns and liked it, but she never thought she would run for office. When she was 27, Emily's List called and asked her to run for Congress. They flew in to see me and said, "All I'd have to do was raise $1 million, Whaley said. "I'm from a working-class family. They might as well have said, 'You need to go to the moon.'" Whaley declined to run for Congress, but realized that she was interested in public office. She ran for the City Commission, the body that governs Dayton, the Montgomery County seat. This county is the fourth largest county in the country that flipped from Obama to Trump population-wise, she said. in 2018, media would come here and say, these white people used to vote for Democrats, and now they don't. They acted like it had just happened. It's been happening since Reagan. America knows depressingly little about itself, she told me. Ignorant responses to the Dayton shooting have aggregated Whaley's sense that people don't really much think about the middle of the country. She said, I mean, come on. The president said, God bless Texas and Toledo. Biden said, we're really thinking about the people of Houston and Michigan. She added, there are still more people in Ohio and across America living in small and mid-sized cities than there are living in big cities. These communities are interesting. It's not, if you've seen one, you've seen them all. Dayton had now joined an unwelcome roster. 253 U.S. cities have suffered a mass shooting this year alone. Across town, the coroner's office was working on the autopsy reports of the Oregon District victims. Megan Betts had been shot in the right forearm and chest. Derek Fudge had been shot multiple times in the torso. Lois Oglesby had been shot in the head. Each name on the list was followed by a coding for race, gender, age, WF-22, BF-39, WM-25, BM-57. Whaley planned to attend as many of the funeral visitations as possible. For now, she had to go. Her security detail was waiting at the door of the restaurant. She left to meet the governor at Dayton Children's Hospital, where they announced a September summit on resilience. This reporting by Paige Williams. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the Laventhal Newsday visiting professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. From the August 5th and 12th, 2019 issue, Robert Mueller's testimony in the garbled language of politics. The words the Democrats and the Republicans used may have been the same, but their meanings were not. This by Amy Davidson Sorkin. One function of the testimony that Robert Mueller, the special counsel who oversaw the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, delivered before two House committees, was to illustrate how various factions in Washington have come to speak different languages. The words may be the same, but the meanings are not. Un-American in the lexicon of Representative Danny Heck, Democrat of Washington, describes people in Donald Trump's orbit who seek to cash in on their positions when dealing with Russians. For Representative Gay Reschenthaler, Republican of Pennsylvania, un-American means Mueller's decision to include in its investigations report so much negative information about a man who happens to be the President of the United States. It's hardly a wonder that Mueller occasionally appeared confused. Each time the questioning swung between the Democrats and the Republicans, he had to switch vernaculars. More than that, Mueller had to navigate two different narrative realms. In the one more grounded in his report, Democrat after Democrat argued that if Trump were not the president, he would have been charged with obstruction of justice. In an exchange with Representative Ted Lieu of California, Mueller briefly appeared to agree that a Justice Department legal opinion that precludes charging a sitting president was all that stopped him from doing so, but later clarified that, because of that opinion, he never got to the point of deciding whether an indictment was merited. Meanwhile, the excitable Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, demanded to know why Mueller had charged 13 Russians no one's ever heard of, but not the guy who put the country through this whole saga. He meant not Donald Trump, but Joseph Mifsud, whom he identified as a mysterious professor who works in Rome and London, and a key figure in the theory, popular on Fox News, that the Trump campaign's alleged Russian contacts were actually just a cleverly engineered setup. As Jordan berated Mueller, he proclaimed what he called the good news. Attorney General William Barr is on the case. This was a reference to Barr's commitment to an inquiry by Michael Horowitz, the Department of Justice's Inspector General, of the counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign that the FBI opened in 2016, and Barr's appointment of John Durham, the Connecticut U.S. attorney, to review the whole affair. The Wall Street Journal said that Barr will never have a more important assignment than pursuing the matter. Lindsey Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, has also pledged to hold hearings. Among other things, Horowitz's investigation concerns how officials handled a dossier assembled by Christopher Steele, a former British intelligence agent with experience in Russia, who was working for a company called Fusion GPS, which had been retained by a law firm hired by Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee. The dossier relates some wild claims, for instance, that knowledgeable sources said the Russians had compromising sexual material on Trump, which have never been substantiated. The thesis on the Trump side is that the dossier was a Russian disinformation operation in which Clinton was complicit. In other words, that's the real collusion. Mueller, citing the Justice Department's continuing inquiries, said the dossier was behind my purview, which only further incensed his questioners. So central has the dossier become to the Republican narrative of Trump's victimhood that, when Mueller appeared slow to recognize the name Fusion GPS, some Fox News figures were left slack-jawed. "What does that say about Robert Mueller?" Tucker Carlson asked. "This isn't a medical program, so we're not going to speculate." Trump retweeted the clip. There are questions worth exploring about the Steele dossier having to do with, say, the transparency of campaign spending. But they are not the questions congressional Republicans are asking. As in their prolonged hearings into the attack on an American diplomatic compound in Benghazi, they are likely to twist any useful threads into an unedifying tangle. This time, though, the Republicans are engaging in an even more dangerous delusion. The pretense is that, as long as they keep talking about mysterious professors and British spies, they aren't ignoring the threat that Russia and other foreign powers continue to pose to the integrity of American elections. Hillary Clinton is, once again, their excuse for inaction. The urgency of focusing on election security was one of Mueller's key messages. It was underscored a day later when the Senate Intelligence Committee released a report indicating that, in 2016, the Russian government likely probed American voting systems in all 50 states. Many of the state systems are known to be vulnerable. The attempts appear to have been mostly exploratory. They may go further, though, in 2020, and Russia might not be the only perpetrator. And yet, that same day, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell killed legislation aimed at bolstering election security, saying that Democrats were just looking for a political benefit. It's not clear that the Republican Party can still conceive of a definition of the country's interests, or of itself, that does not include support for Trump. This was thus all the more striking during Mueller's testimony, when certain Democrats seemed to be speaking his language, that of a straightforward officer of the law. One such moment came when Val Demings of Florida, previously Orlando's chief of police, asked about the written responses that Trump had submitted to Mueller in lieu of sitting for an interview with his investigators. Was it true that Trump simply didn't answer many questions? Mueller: true. Did he give answers that contradicted other evidence? Mueller: yes. Could Mueller say that the president was credible? Mueller: I can't answer that question. Was it fair to say, Demings continued, that the president's answers were not only inadequate, but, quote, showed that he wasn't always being truthful, close quote? Mueller: quote, I would say generally, close quote. That exchange is almost a catechism for keeping one's bearings amid the tumult of a truth-mocking presidency. Such a task won't be easy in what is bound to be a bitter election, when the contested terms will include not only un-American, but a more essential one, American. This by Amy Davidson Sorkin, a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2014. Also from the issue of August 5th and 12th, here's something combining another branch of the government, the Supreme Court, but this time it's Justice Stevens' dissenting Shakespeare theory. Among the late Supreme Court justices' controversial opinions, a belief that the Bard's works were actually written by Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford. By Tyler Fogut. Last Tuesday at the funeral for Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, Ruth Bader Ginsburg delivered a eulogy. She concluded, "Justice Stevens much appreciated the writings of the literary genius known by the name William Shakespeare, so I will end with a line from the Bard befitting the prince of a man Justice Stevens was. Take him for all in all, we shall not look upon his like again." Ginsburg's wording was careful. It had to be, lest she mischaracterize her colleague's views. Stevens didn't appreciate the writings of Shakespeare. He appreciated the writings of the individual known as Shakespeare. Ginsburg's Hamlet quote, "Stevens, known for his dissenting opinions, such as Bush v. Gore, Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, believed that it was probably written not by Shakespeare, the commoner from Stratford-upon-Avon, but by Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford." A quick recap of the Oxfordian theory, which was proposed in 1920 by a schoolteacher named J. Thomas Looney. Shakespeare was the front man for de Vere, an aristocrat who could not publish under his own name. Writers were looked down on. Sometimes they were even tortured or killed. This explains why there were no books in Shakespeare's Stratford House, and why no letters written by Shakespeare survive. Some Oxfordians think that Shakespeare was illiterate. This explains why there is no evidence that Stratford's citizens recognized Shakespeare as a writer during his lifetime, and it explains why the plays are so good, so complicated, so familiar with the concerns of nobility and the geography of Italy. Shakespeare isn't known to have ever left England. Stevens began expressing his doubts about the Bard of Avon in November of 1987 at a moot court hearing on the topic, "Who Wrote Shakespeare?" Stevens and Justices William Brennan and Harry Blackmun listened to arguments in support of the Stratford man and arguments in support of de Vere. Stevens said of the Stratford argument, "I have lingering concerns about some of the gaps in the evidence, the absence of eulogies at the time in 1666 when Shakespeare died." He added, "You can't help but have these gnawing doubts that this author may perhaps have been someone else." A few years later, in a Law Review article, he doubled down, citing the theory that Shakespeare is a pseudonym for an exceptionally well-educated person of noble birth who was close to the English throne, Edward de Vere. The article was him coming out as an Oxfordian, said Tom Regnier, a former president of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. The organization, which has about 400 members, including the Shakespearean actors Derek Jacobi and Mark Rylance, who are honorary trustees, is dedicated to researching the authorship question and evangelizing about de Vere. In 2009, the group gave Stevens its highest honor, naming him Oxfordian of the Year. Alex McNeil, the Oxfordian who was tasked with notifying Stevens, didn't know how to contact a Supreme Court justice, so he mailed a letter to the court. Several weeks later, he received a response from Stevens' secretary. "Be here on November 12th at 2 p.m. "They didn't ask, is such and such a date good for you?" McNeil said. Regnier, McNeil, and two other Oxfordians, all attorneys, arrived at Stephen's chambers to present him with a plaque. They chatted about the authorship question. Mike Pispia, one of the Oxfordians who joined, said that Stephens made it clear that he was an anti-Stratfordian, but that he shied away from endorsing a definitive theory of authorship. He said, "Of course it's not the guy from Stratford," Pisapia recalled, "but when we asked about the other candidates, he'd say things like, 'Oh, I don't bite.' 'What about Bacon?' 'No, I don't bite.' 'Okay, so what about Oxford?' He said, 'Well, you certainly couldn't convict anyone else of it.'" But the award was not rebuffed. "He accepted it with both hands, literally," Pisapia said. The Oxfordians understood Stephen's reluctance to commit. "Let's say some piece of evidence comes out and proves that it was Queen Elizabeth I," Pisapia said. "His whole career as a jurist would have had a shadow over it. Like, 'Wow, he sure missed that one.'" Although the reputation of Hugh Trevor Roper, the historian, never quite recovered after he authenticated the Hitler diaries, Whoopi Goldberg's career didn't suffer when she raised doubts about the moon landing on The View. The late Justice Antonin Scalia was openly Oxfordian. Scalia told the Wall Street Journal in 2009 that his wife thinks we Oxfordians can't believe that a commoner would have done something like this. You know, it's an aristocratic tendency. Scalia was never named Oxfordian of the Year. McNeil said, "We're often accused of snobbery by the other side, but we're not saying that someone from a small town, a four-day trip away from London, couldn't have done this. It's that he couldn't have done this without leaving any evidence behind. And for lawyers, it's the evidentiary question that sticks out the most." The Oxfordians are busy planning their annual conference, which will be held this fall at the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut. Twain was skeptical of the Stratford man, and his last book, Is Shakespeare Dead?, addresses the authorship question. "We'll do something to honor Stevens," Regnier said. Pisapia credits Stevens, as well as the 2011 film Anonymous, with bringing the Oxfordian theory into the mainstream. He said, 30 years ago, if you talked about the authorship question, you were lumped in with the flat earthers, with the people who were going to stake out Area 51. The Stevens thing wasn't so groundbreaking to the rest of the world. It wasn't like Beyonce having twins, but it made it more acceptable to talk about. This by Toler Fogat. He's an editor of the Talk of the Town section in The New Yorker. And now for some music. From the August 19th issue, Eric Wolfgang Korngold, the opera composer who went Hollywood. His melodic gift rivaled Puccini's, but his reputation suffered when he began writing movie scores. Now the classical world is giving him a fresh listen. This by Alex Ross. "That sounds like film music," is a put-down that deserves to be retired. The usual intention is to dismiss a work as splashy kitsch. Over the past century, though, enough first-rate music has been written for the movies that the charge rings false. Hollywood composers have employed so many different styles that the term film music has little descriptive value. Worst is when the pejorative is used to discount figures who brought distinctive personalities to the scoring business, thereby elevating it. Such was the fate of the composer Eric Wolfgang Korngold, who began his career in Vienna as one of the most astonishing child prodigies in musical history, and who reached maximum fame writing film scores in Los Angeles in the 1930s and 40s. A master of late romantic opulence, Korngold shaped the sonic texture of Golden Age Hollywood. To say that his work sounds like movie music is an elementary fallacy, a confusion of cause and effect. The Bard Music Festival, which has been exploring neglected corners of the repertory for the past three decades, is honoring Korngold in this year's edition, which began on August 9th at Bard College in upstate New York. In addition, Leon Botstein, Bard's president and musical ringleader, recently conducted the American premiere of Das Wunder der Helion, The Miracle of Helion, Korngold's second full-length opera on the campus. These performances echo an ongoing Korngold revival in Europe. Die Tote Stadt, The Dead City, the composer's first mature opera, had a production at La Scala earlier this year, and in the fall it will be staged at the Bavarian State Opera with the star tenor Jonas Kaufmann heading the cast. The missing link is the Met, which presented Die Tote Stadt in the early 1920s but has yet to return to it. I cannot fathom why that opera is not as popular as anything by Puccini. Its melodic writing is no less indelible, its expressive urgency no less intense. Korngold, the son of a leading Viennese music critic, was himself something of a miracle. By his mid-teens, he had not only acquired total technical command of the art of composition, but had also developed an unmistakable voice. Although he knew his Puccini, Mahler, and Richard Strauss, he was far more than a clever imitator. In the scherzo of his Sinfonietta, completed in 1913 when he was 16, Korngold is speaking his own language, melodies bound along with rhythmic freedom, harmonies ricochet from one major triad to another, a full-strength orchestra glitters and dances before the ears. Even more astounding are the one-act operas Der Ring des Polykratz of 1914 and Violanta of 1916, which overflow with effortlessly effective vocal writing. In the annals of composing prodigies, Korngold's only serious rival is Felix Mendelssohn. Mozart's youthful pieces lack comparative individuality. Like many Wunderkinder, Korngold had a bumpy transition to adulthood. Die Tote Stadt, which had its premiere in 1920 when the composer was 23, promised a long and triumphant operatic career. The work had the benefit of a deliciously decadent story based on George Rodenbach's symbolist novel, Bruges la Mort. A widower is wandering through the Flemish city, obsessively mourning his wife, when he meets a dancer who uncannily resembles the dead woman. Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo offers another variation on Rodenbach's scenario. Korngold alternates between tunes of indelible potency and shimmering, dreamlike textures. Das Wunder, which was first performed in 1927, met an unhappier fate. Although the initial response was strong, the composer's Art Nouveau aesthetic came to seem dated amid rapidly moving trends of the 20s. 12-tone music, Stravinskyan neoclassicism, the music theater of Kurt Weill. Julius Korngold, the composer's father, did not help matters by waging an obnoxious campaign against Ernst Krenek's jazz-inflected opera Johnny Spielt Auf, which made the rounds in the same period. Performances of Das Wunder in Berlin aroused a savage press reaction. Korngold completed only one more opera, the entrancing but dramatically weak Die Katharine from 1937. Korngold was Jewish, and the Nazi takeover of Austria forced him into exile. He had begun establishing himself in Hollywood as early as 1934, and therefore never faced the economic struggles that other émigrés encountered. Still, his vitality as a film composer, evident in such Errol Flynn swashbucklers as The Adventures of Robin Hood and The Seahawk, damaged his reputation as a serious talent. After the Second World War, when Korngold attempted to resume his concert career, he was deemed hopelessly retrograde by the modernist standards of the day. He died young, at the age of 60, in 1957. Only in the 1970s did interest in his work reawaken. in part because John Williams paid homage to him in the main title theme of Star Wars, a magnificently Korngold-esque invention. I got to know Das Wunder der Helene through a 1993 recording on the Decca label, part of an invaluable series called Entartet Music, or Degenerate Music, honoring composers who suffered under the Nazis. My initial sense was of a ravishing score that had little chance of finding a place in the modern repertory. The libretto by Hans Müller is based on a 1917 play by the Austrian dramatist Hans Kaltnecker, who specialized in expressionist mysticism. The ruler, a harsh governor of an unnamed realm, is confronted by the charismatic, Christ-like stranger who enters into an ambiguous relationship with the ruler's wife, Helene. The miracle of the title consists of Helene bringing about the resurrection of the stranger who has killed himself in an effort to save her from accusations of adultery. Love wins out in the end, to put it briefly. At Bard, the director Christian Roth and the designer Esther Bialas dealt with the overall libretto by transplanting the action to a vaguely futuristic dystopian setting. Steel gray tones predominate. The judges of the ruler's kingdom wear inquisitorial scarlet robes, and the stranger is dressed in an orange jumpsuit as he undergoes interrogation. Botstein, conducting the American Symphony, reined in the ecstatic excesses of Korngold's orchestration, establishing a more sober, clear-cut sound. The result was a surprisingly stage-worthy parable of totalitarian oppression and spiritual resistance. The Lithuanian soprano, Osrin Stundit, a rising star in Europe, sang the role of Helene. Although she lacks an ideal shining timbre, she's a piercingly expressive singer-actor who kept the audience engaged in Helene's obscure predicament. Daniel Brenna, as the stranger, struggled with the lyrical aspects of Korngold's writing, but delivered the part with vigor. Alfred Walker brought a rugged Wagnerian sound to the ruler, suggesting that agony lay behind the character's imperious poses. The young bass baritone, Nicholas Brownlee, stood out in the smaller role of the porter, filling the auditorium with a handsome mahogany tone. On the 1993 recording, this part was sung by a young René Pop. A similarly starry future may be in store for Brownlee. The Bard Festival, entitled Korngold and His World, includes a semi-staged rendition of Die Tote Stadt, a survey of the composer's chamber music, a sampling of its film scores, and a performance of his symphony in F-sharp, which he completed in 1952. The symphony pivots on an adagio of almost shocking, tragic power, a funeral rite for the destroyed world of the composer's youth. In that movement, Korngold quotes from his scores for the private lives of Elizabeth and Essex, Captain Blood, and Anthony Adverse, but he alters the material almost beyond recognition, as if to demonstrate that the Hollywood stereotype cannot confine him. Out of the stuff of film music, he fashions what may be the last great symphony of the German Romantic tradition. This by Alex Ross, The New Yorker's music critic since 1996. And that is all we have time for today. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been The New Yorker Hour. Be back with you again next week. We'll go out with Korngold music. Bye-bye.